administrative science as well. And this is kind of the role that William Petty comes to play in the Royal Society and that what that project is about.
Bureaucracy, right, comes about in this context of the 18th century, the liberal nation-state project, right, and the Enlightenment absolutism, right? And it's like, that's when sovereign power is consolidated in the central government, in the monarch. And in conjunction with that, the state has to develop this gigantic bureaucracy because it's basically undermining the position of the hereditary aristocracy and the management of all this land, and they're taking over these resources from these other groups. The nation state came about, and that involved taking all that back and consolidating it into like a trust company, basically, which is the sovereign. In that context, that's when like bureaucracy comes about, and they need all these tools and techniques and methods in order to then generate information about what's going on in the country. Empiricism is needed for that, and that's where you have all these statistical methods and like demographics and stuff, those kinds of techniques for analyzing that, measuring it. That's where they all start coming into play.
Yeah, and that's interesting because like it is kind of like, I guess, like an Enlightenment 2.0, you know, in the context of this machinery question. Because one of the like big things that they kind of try to put in motion was this thing called the Mechanics Institutes. And yeah, these were basically like broad kind of like intellectual places where people could go and they could learn kind of like technical sciences, you know, engineering, everything of that nature. But it was also coupled to, you know, like even more wider ranging questions. Like one person who was involved in a lot of this, like March of the Intellect and Mechanics Institute, machinery question stuff, is a guy named William Thompson. And he wrote a book, let me pull the title up, it's really wordy, An Inquiry into the Principles of the Distribution of Wealth Most Conducive to Humane Happiness Applied to the Newly Proposed System of Voluntary Equality of Wealth. And so this was published in 1824, very classic title for that period. But he, in this book, introduces the whole the distinction between like physical labor and mental labor, you know, which will be pretty important because like people like Charles Babbage really kind of like start incorporating this into the division of labor proper. But what makes like Thompson like so interesting is that he's really like kind of basing himself on like he's critical of Malthus. Very contrary to Malthus, but he's very influenced by William Godwin. And so, you know, I think you all talked about this kind of like the Godwin Malthus dynamic in your episode with Logo, the debates around all that, Darwin. And so that's where Thompson is like really coming from. And he sees the machinery question like in the context of these debates. And so he proposes like a new mode of inquiry to kind of navigate these waters. And to describe this new mode of inquiry, he introduces the term social science for it. And so this is where the term social science comes.
Yeah, that's really, that's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. I thought you'd like that. I was excited to drop that.
You know, yeah, it's a whole history there too, of basically how these different new social sciences come about long before the term is actually used. Obviously, this is a whole process that runs through the Enlightenment, right? And I really think it goes right back to Pufendorf's idea of society, its new importance in international law, is that comes about so that, and that makes it possible to study society. And so all these new things start branching up to do that. And that involved literally economics and anthropology, the social sciences, is that's where they all come from. People trying to develop different methodologies for measuring society, figuring out what it is.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what he's exactly trying to do here. He kind of has like a quasi-utilitarian view, actually. It's like, you know, like questions like how do you achieve like egalitarian distribution? And so obviously to like understand that, you kind of have to like unlock this whole mode of understanding society in general. So I think it definitely kind of taps into the tradition that you're describing, maybe kind of puts it in a more kind of like classic Anglo-liberal perspective.
Unlock, huh? Well, that reminds me, we should talk a little bit about the objective empirical side of the development of economics here, because it's really, let's just stop and talk about Locke for a second, because we don't want to skip over him. So for Locke, laws and rules and the natural law and moral law were external ideas which were acquired through experience and sense. When we talk about Locke and the blank slate, what we're talking about is a priori ideas, because that's what Locke is denying. He's denying innate ideas which are accessible through pure reason alone. This is in contrast to metaphysical thinking, to the rationalist tradition, to thinkers coming after Descartes, thinkers like Spinoza and Leibniz and Berkeley. Rationalism follows a chain of syllogistic deduction. The point of rationalist metaphysics is to arrive at knowledge of God, of the cosmos and providence, and its, the soul and its immortality in heaven and hell, etc., using a chain of syllogistic reasoning. Locke says, "It seems to me a little too much confidence of our own wisdom to say, I think it best, therefore God hath made it so." Locke is arguing with the subjectivity of these kinds of deductions. Reason is a subjective faculty. It deals with relations and laws. And this echoes something that William Petty says in his description of how political arithmetic is going to work. To quote Petty, he says, "For instead of using only comparative and intellectual arguments, I have taken the course, as a specimen of the political arithmetic I have long aimed at, to express myself in terms of number, weight, or measure, to use only arguments of sense, and to consider only such cases as have visible foundations in nature, leaving those that depend upon the mutable minds, opinions, appetites, and passions of particular men to the consideration of others." Locke falls on Francis Bacon, and he emphasizes an empiricist experiential method of gaining knowledge, one that's based on induction, which was how Bacon formed it. And so knowledge of those things must be discovered using the senses. Otherwise, Locke asks, why did God even give us senses? If we could simply deduce various pieces of knowledge about the world, why would we need any kind of sensation in order to go and experience anything? But this was a big part of Baconianism, was augmenting the senses using, they saw a commonplace book as kind of a cybernetic enhancement of memory, as the same way that they saw a viewing lens, like a telescope, as a cybernetic enhancement of sight, of viewings. And that's a big part of Baconianism and the Baconian project that William Petty was a part of, that the Royal Society takes up, was the technical arts and machines, and they really wanted to improve the status of those. That was one of their main objectives, not only to reform science theoretically, but to make science work for the common man, so to speak, as they were engaged in this reformational project. And that is a theme that runs throughout the 18th and 19th centuries and is going to influence much later writers like Ricardo, for example, which I believe you were going to talk about.
It's the third edition of Ricardo's On the Principles of Taxation and Political Economy. And this was the third edition in 1821. And what makes this one like really notable is the fact that this is where his infamous chapter on machinery was introduced. And this is like a really interesting little text, because it actually is a shift in Ricardo's way of thinking. He talks about how he had previously seen the machine. And, you know, when we say machines, it is the steam engine that is the big one. So it's a little nice little callback to our steam engines in the cybernetics episode. He thought machines largely benefited everybody. He thought that as machines were integrated deeper and deeper into production, that the national wealth would increase because you have increased productivity, more commodities. He thought as a consequence, there would be an increase in laborers' incomes. But he, somewhere along the ways, and it's not exactly clear what signaled his shift, he doesn't really say, he now thinks that the machine itself is detrimental to labor. It eliminates the demand for labor in the economy. And so he goes on talking about the downside of the machine. He talks about, yeah, the laboring classes will diminish, but at the same time, you do have increasing revenue of the country in question. And so he finally gets to the end of this section, and this is, I think, the most interesting part. He says, the statements which I have made will not, I hope, lead to the inference that the machinery should not be encouraged. The employment of machinery could never be safely discouraged in a state. And he talks about how you basically, on the one hand, the machine hurts labor. But on the other hand, by not using the machine, the country is hurt because it's going to lose on those revenues that you would gain from the use of productive machinery. And also, you're talking in the context of international competition, a world market. Everybody else is using machines, and say, like, one country opts not to use machines, well, they're going to lose in general. So you're going to have to, like, Ricardo basically sets up a choice between the welfare of the country or the welfare of the working class. And he says, you know, you got to do it. Don't not do machinery for the sake of the laborers, which is a really interesting question. And it kicked off in the 1820s, this really kind of huge social question in Britain. It was called the machinery question. And it was about the uses and abuses of machinery in relation to the social problems, the overpopulation in urban centers, the rampant poverty and questions of vice. A lot of people connected all these things up with what Ricardo was saying about the lowering demands on labor. And so there was this whole reckoning that happened in the 1820s, you know, and into the 1830s and beyond, really. How do you solve the machinery problem?
The pamphlet from 1821, so actually the same year that Ricardo wrote the machinery question, and it was published anonymously, but it was later learned that the author was Charles Wentworth Dilke, who was actually part of the same, like, kind of circles around Shelley and them. So that's interesting. This also is kind of like an alternative approach to the machinery question. He starts off by affirming, like Marx does later, that labor is the source of revenue. It's ultimately from labor working that profit is ultimately produced. And so the more you have of a reserve labor, the more your wealth, the wealth of the nation increases. But he notices this increased dynamic of mechanizing labor and the elimination of labor, much like Ur. But he says this eats away at money. Money itself, if you keep increasing the mechanization of labor, you cut down your reserve of labor, then money itself is destabilized over like the longer and longer terms. And what the conclusion that he draws from this is he talks about how you keep increasing mechanization, you make it possible to where you can reevaluate what wealth is. And if you don't measure national wealth in monetary terms, what do you measure it in? And he has this really interesting quote where he says, wealth is liberty, liberty to seek recreation, liberty to enjoy life, liberty to improve the mind. It is disposable time and nothing more. And so he's defining the true wealth, the kind of the wealth of the future, as time that is no longer dominated by production and the dictates of the economy, which you can see how that like flows into Marx, because Marx at one point like defines the economy. He says that every economy is an organization of time. And so you had this idea that like free time is what wealth will be measured in. But Dilke, he makes this interesting point where, well, because it destabilizes money, the capitalists will never let us get to that point. And they will even engage in the destruction of their own machines in order to prevent this point from being achieved. And in this, I think that he really anticipates Thorstein Veblen, who in 1921, he wrote a book called The Engineers and the Price System. And in that book, he raises a really similar point where he talks about how this is, you know, the 20s, like we're really advanced in terms of our industrial system. The market, the price system is kind of being destabilized by it. We need something else to replace it. For him, it's like a system run by engineers. But in this book, he actually raises the idea that people committed to the price system effectively engage in like industrial sabotage, where they repress the full potentials of the machinery that's there.
See, we're bridging all of history here. We're bringing it all together. We're doing some incredible stuff here with this.
Yeah, every day it's like a convergent wave, you know, all the pieces that were initially dispersed, distributed across the epigenetic landscape. It's coming together. It's a phase shift. You know, this is creative evolution.
Mr. Speaker, you will inform the members of this House that their presence is no longer required by the nation. This Parliament is, by my authority, terminated, dissolved.
This is complicated stuff. We're bringing it all together here. We started off, in the last episode, we got all this cybernetic stuff. We're going to bring it all together.
Your Majesty!
And go through the physiocrats and tie it all together with these cybernetic metaphors.
Are you aware that by your action in this House today, you may have pushed this nation to the brink of civil war?
Back to the Restoration, back to William Petty, right? I mean, we're bridging all the divides here, synthesizing history.
Access main program. Access main security. Access main program grid.
Hold on to your butts.
Obviously, we want to talk about William Petty, but who are the fathers of political economy prior to him? Where is he drawing his influences in? So we're going to walk back just a little bit. I want to mention a few of his sources. Is that we have a guy named Samuel Hartlieb. We have Thomas Hobbes is another. Francis Bacon is going to be a big one. We're going to talk more about him in just a little bit. And another guy named James Harrington. He has kind of an eclectic mix of figures. You usually associate these people with the history of political economy. They're not known as economists, certainly, really. Perhaps Hobbes a little bit. Another source is a William Harvey, the physician. He's an English physician who lived from 1578 to 1657. And he's mostly known for, well, in terms of his influence on political economy, he's known for his work on the heart. And that's going to be important, as you see, because we're dealing again with all these biological, physiological metaphors. And there's actually a tension, too, that we're going to get into, a tension between physics and Copernicus and medicine and biology, which you can see with beginning with William Harvey. A lot of these figures in this history of political economy are one or the either, or they generally slant towards being physicians. You know, Thomas Hobbes, William Petty, there's a lot of influences there. We're going to talk more specifically about how William Harvey's work on the heart serves as an important metaphor that's going to inform the development of political economy. But the one figure I do want to hone in on here is one of the more interesting ones. He's James Harrington, and he's a very strange, ambiguous figure, and one of the most important scholars when it comes to early political history of the 17th century, of this era that we're talking about, is J.G.A. Pocock. And Pocock has, over the years, upheld James Harrington as the crucial figure in the history of modern republicanism. And he sets up a line, especially linking Harrington to Machiavelli. And sometimes the existence of a school called the Neo-Republican School or the Neo-Machiavellians is posited by people like Pocock, but that also has been challenged. More recent scholarship, there's a biography by Rachel Hammersley, James Harrington, an intellectual biography that came out in 2019. That challenges Pocock's interpretation. It really complicates it. the author of that biography doesn't come to any strong conclusions otherwise in terms of interpreting Harrington differently than Pocock in a definitive sense. It really just opens up the interpretive field on who Harrington was and where he came from and what his ideas actually were. So he's a very, like I said, ambiguous figure in history. Harrington is best known for writing in 1656 a book called The Commonwealth of Oceania, and it, as it sounds, is a utopian constitutional work about a theoretical or ideal republican form of government that he was proposing during the time of the aftermath of the English Civil War for what he envisioned England should be following that event. So following the Stuart Restoration, which is 1660, Harrington is actually arrested for republican activity of some kind, and there's a lot of questions about that, about what exactly happened, but he was locked up and then went mad under some circumstances, and there's a lot of dispute about what exactly his madness consisted of. Some contemporaries said that it was palsy. Some people said that he was poisoned. People in his family believed he was poisoned. It was foul play of some kind. So there's a lot of interpretations there. So it paints a certain picture of, you have this guy, James Harrington. He's involved in Republican politics during the period following the Civil War. He's writing these utopias about the Commonwealth of Oceania. And then the Stuarts come back in the Restoration, and they lock him up for his political activities. And then he's poisoned, perhaps, to silence him or something. It paints a certain picture, but it's really way more ambiguous than that. And it's not really clear, reading his biography, his most recent biography, a personal James Harrington never emerges. You never really get a sense of his internal ideas, his internal beliefs, who he was as a person. It all remains up in the air because not a lot is actually known about Harrington before he becomes politically active in the 1650s, even though he is born in 1611. So really, there are records that exist for him that talk about his earlier activities, and he did take a trip to the mainland, to the continent of Europe, but there's questions, like I said, abound about what any of that consisted of, because we're going to see there's some seriously weird little things about his personal history here. So James Harrington had a cousin who is also named James Harrington. And the James Harrington that we are concerned with, who wrote The Commonwealth of Oceania, he's the son of Sapkowitz Harrington, and his cousin is the son of one Edward Harrington. And Sapkowitz and Edward Harrington's father is named James Harrington. And James Harrington had a brother named John Harrington. And here's the thing about John Harrington. John Harrington and his wife actually raised Elizabeth Stuart. So that's the funny thing here, is that they had a previous relationship with the Stuarts going back quite a ways, actually. So who's Elizabeth Stuart, right? So James VI of England has two children. His daughter is Elizabeth Stuart, and his son is Charles I, the King of England. So as we know, Charles I is deposed in the English Civil War, and his son eventually comes to power as Charles II. Right, that's well known. We've established that already. But what about Elizabeth Stuart? What about James VI's daughter? Elizabeth Stuart is married off in a wedding ceremony planned by Francis Bacon himself to Frederick V. And Frederick V is the Palatinate Elector of the Holy Roman Empire. So the Emperor of the Romans of the Holy Roman Empire is elected by seven princes, seven prince electors. One of these is the Palatinate Elector. Frederick V is one of these prince electors, and he marries Elizabeth Stuart. And this is actually what the Rosicrucian manuscripts are about, is that the Rosicrucian manuscripts are a kind of hoax or a warning or a threat to the Catholic hegemony on the European mainland. And what they're saying is that basically England has entered into a new alliance with this Protestant state, with the Palatinate Elector, Frederick V, and that they're going to fight or resist or form a coalition of some kind to resist Catholic dominance on the continent. Elizabeth Stuart goes with her new husband, Frederick V, and they go back to Heidelberg Castle, and they build an incredible alchemical garden full of automatons and mechanical fountains and all types of wonders. Frederick V then goes on to start the Thirty Years' War in an event known as the Bohemian Rebellion. Frederick V's son and heir is Charles Louis. And when Frederick V dies, James Harrington, yes, the James Harrington that we all know and love that wrote The Commonwealth of Oceania, he assists
Charles Louis in conducting his business in England. And when James Harrington had gone to the continent growing up on his educational tour, he visited the court of Frederick V. And as we have noted, his family was close with the Stuarts and especially with Elizabeth Stuart. And the reason for this is that John Harrington and John Harrington's wife actually took in Elizabeth Stuart and saved her from the gunpowder plot. And there was actually a plot by the Catholics to kidnap Elizabeth Stuart and raise her Catholic. And Harrington's family had stepped in. John Harrington had stepped in and prevented that and saved Elizabeth Stuart. And they ended up taking her in and raising her for their friends, the Stuarts, for James VI. Don't you love how complicated this is? Because this is what really throws a strange light on the whole history of the republicanism that we're talking about with James Harrington and what it actually means. Is because, first of all, James Harrington, as we said, has a cousin who's also named James Harrington. So we have these public records during the Civil War where a James Harrington is sometimes conducting business for Parliament. On an occasion or two, he donates money to Parliament when they're trying to raise funds, but it's not at all clear which James Harrington it actually is, of course. And you also have this other James Harrington, our James Harrington, the James Harrington who wrote Commonwealth of Oceania, who is conducting business on behalf of Charles Louis, who is the son of Frederick V, who is married to Elizabeth Stuart, right? And Charles Louis is actually positioning himself at the same time in two visits to England that he makes immediately prior to the outbreak of the Civil War. Charles Louis is positioning himself to side with Parliament. And this is partially because Charles Louis needs money, because his father, Frederick V, has died, and he's burdened with some very bad situations in terms of debt and in terms of what's also going on in the European continent with his struggles against the Catholics and with the 30 Years' War and the events that are surrounding that and are coming about as a consequence. So he inherits all of that. He's trying to maneuver himself. He's trying to maneuver himself against his uncle, Charles I, with Parliament to get on Parliament's side, though I'm not sure whether or not he's doing this because he wants to perhaps take over as King of England, or he just wants Parliament's assistance in the form of money, which Charles I does also grant him. But in any event, when Charles Louis is away, James Harrington is acting as his designated agent in England. Now, where this all gets additionally complicated is that, as you know, during the Glorious Revolution, the Stuarts are deposed. James II is Charles II's brother, and he's tossed off the throne. And William III of Orange comes in and becomes king in conjunction with the Anglican daughter, Mary. And this then leads to a settlement eventually when Queen Anne passes away, where the throne passes to the House of Hanover to George I. But who is George I? George I's mom, his mother, is the daughter of Elizabeth Stuart. Yes, that's correct. So the way that this actually comes about, Leibniz is involved, believe it or not. And that Leibniz is a historian, if you recall, is he's actually a librarian. He's working for the House of Hanover. He's working on a giant historical work that serves to justify the pedigree of the House of Hanover Dukes. So Leibniz is involved then when it comes to settling the succession of Queen Anne. He deploys his bibliographic, his historical skills as a researcher and a historian to come in and advocate for the line descending from Elizabeth Stuart to then go onto the throne of England, which does end up happening with George I, who becomes King of England. And so it all goes in a big circle, a big strange circle here. But the ultimate point, maybe, not to get too intricate and too involved to confuse you too much, because this is quite confusing, the ultimate point is that James Harrington is not a parliamentarian in the super conventional sense. He is allied with the other Stuarts, with Elizabeth Stuart and with her descendants by family blood, and that sort of puts him in alliance with Parliament against Charles I, at least. But this is the big ambiguity that you can see that I'm trying to get at here, is that he should not be thought of as a modern Republican necessarily for this reason and for a few others. So James Harrington, as we've seen, he has a kind of a complicated history, so is reputation as a Republican, it has to be taken in historical context, and there's several different components of that that are worth noting. The thing about his Commonwealth of Oceania is that it's a basically a constitution that has a narrative dressing to it, a narrative frame, and it has some unique features to it. For example, it uses several different typefaces in it. It has a kind of a complicated printing history behind it, and it actually employs a lot of literary, I guess what you might even call metafictional techniques or stylistic techniques to it that make it kind of unique in a lot of ways. One of the things that he does is he actually uses a very interesting combination of terminology. He uses a strange combination of terminology like polemarch, archon, stargus, and then he also combines that with English constitutional practice like parish, justice of the peace, high constable. And then he has all these other phrases or kind of cosmological words that he incorporates like military orb, galaxy,